Jeremiah, Genesis 25 is where we are, verse 19. Excuse me. So before this, it stretches all the way back to, back to the beginning, but as far as Abraham's call, going back to the end of chapter 11, into chapter 12, there were some promises that God made to Abraham. What were those promises? And they have to do with
land and seed.
Land and seed, and then that's tied up with blessing, right? Yeah, so land, seed, blessing. What's the outcome for Abraham relative to those promises? When you get to the end of chapter 24, or in the beginning of chapter 25, what happened with those promises?
Didn't possess the land.
Okay, didn't possess the land, but he did have what, as far as the land goes?
A tiny bit of it.
Yeah, what was it?
The caves at something.
Yeah, Machpelah.
There you go, that he buried.
Yeah, the burial plot. And the burial plot is a statement of faith that this land belongs to, this land belongs to us, according to God's promise. So yeah, there's the land. And he was also told that his descendants would not be in the land for about 400 years. They'd be in bondage, and then they would come back in, right? So he's told that. God tells him that in Genesis 15. So Abraham knows that possession of the land is not happening now, but he does purchase that burial plot that says something major about the future. What about the other promises? So a seed and blessing.
He takes another wife and has a bunch of kids.
No. Before that, he does have a bunch of kids, but he sends them away. There's something bigger that happens before that.
Isaac
is born by whom?
By Sarah.
Yeah, it's okay. By Sarah, and this is miraculous. They're both beyond the age where they can have children. They weren't having children, and then Abram does end up having a child with Hagar, but Isaac comes along, and he's the one who carries the promise. He's the one who carries the blessing forward, right? And then at the end of Abraham's life. The blessing that was on Abraham goes to Isaac. I'm trying to find it. Gave all that he had to Isaac there in verse 5. So that blessing, now that's material blessing, but from God. And but there's also something more than material blessing that's in store for the family. And now we had a couple of a genealogy with Ishmael that kind of wraps up his story, because he comes back to participate in burying Abraham. And now we get to Isaac. What happened in chapter 24 with Isaac? Abraham sends his servant to fulfill a mission. And what was that mission?
Find a wife.
Find a wife specific,
specific
from a specific family in a specific town. And she is found. It's an amazing thing. And the servant brings Rebekah back to, not to Abraham, but to Isaac. And what does the servant call Isaac?
My master.
So that transition is pointed to there, and now in chapter 25 we actually see the fullness of it. And here at the end of chapter 25, we basically have, so Isaac is an interesting character because he's not really the main character anywhere. He's got a couple things coming up in chapter 26, but he's not really the main deal. And so Abraham's life is like, there's promises involved with reference to Isaac. Those are fulfilled. But then once you get to Isaac's life, it's really more about his sons and Jacob in particular than it is with Isaac. And so Isaac is always the with reference to. He's like always, he's kind of part of things, but he's not the main thing. However, there are some things that happen with Isaac, both positive and negative, good and bad, to learn from and remember that this is given to us for our instruction. But really, what we're given here is the background to the rivalry between Esau and Jacob, and their descendants, Edom and Israel. And we have basically three different units, sections in the rest of chapter 25 talking about this this rivalry. First, God talks about it. He says that this is what's going on in your womb, Rebecca. And then there's the birth, and then there's the birthright, right? So that's basically how the passage moves. But first, there's the issue of actually Rebecca being pregnant, getting pregnant. So starting with that, I'll read through the Lord's speech in verse 23 here. So these are the generations of Isaac, Abraham's son. Abraham fathered Isaac, and Isaac was 40 years old when he took Rebekah, the daughter of Bethuel, the Aramean of Padan Aram, the sister of Laban, the Aramean, to be his wife. And Isaac prayed to the Lord for his wife because she was barren, and the Lord granted his prayer, and Rebekah, his wife, conceived. The children struggled together within her, and she said, "If it is thus..." Actually, I want to stop at verse 21. So just in those three verses, what observations do you make? Even if it's the most like mundane of observations.
She was barren.
Okay, she's barren.
I think I said last time, like, you know, Ishmael's... These are the generation of Ishmael, and then all these names, and then these are the generations of Isaac. She couldn't conceive.
Problem.
What?
Yeah. Good. So what about these are the generations of Isaac? Why is that, in the context of Genesis, why is that important?
It's a new section.
Yeah, new section. So, and that actually starts all the way back in chapter 2. It says these are the generations of the heavens and the earth, right?
Right.
So carries forward. The last time we saw this, it was at the end of chapter 11 with the generations of Terah. Which is Abraham's father. Okay, so now, new section. We've officially begun Isaac's story, but what we need to know about Isaac is that he's Abraham's son, right? So that's an interesting thing. It doesn't just stop at Isaac. It's Isaac is Abraham's son. So we're reminded of Isaac being the promised son. And he's here. He's living. What other what other observations?
He's 40. So like he's 40. Kind of a place marker as we follow his life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. He's 40. When is he? He's 40 here. And that's in reference to what? What significant event in his life?
Marriage.
Yeah. With marriage. Yeah. So he's 40 years old when he took Rebekah. And she's this person, daughter of Bethuel, sister of Laban. So we met Bethuel back in chapter 24. And then Laban, we also met in chapter 24, but we're also going to see him later on when we get to chapter 29.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting that he was mentioned there.
Yeah.
And that's because he's going to come up again.
Yeah, so Laban's like, he's lurking in the background in that dark alley.
Yes.
I don't understand why they wanted a wife from that same family when they weren't even practicing the same religion as them.
Well, we don't know actually what they were practicing.
But Laban, it says, like, a little bit forward, he has all these idols and stuff.
Oh, yeah.
It's like when Rebecca takes the idol.
Yeah.
It doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah, that's a good question. It's a really direct question, too.
I don't know what that means.
It doesn't make any sense to me. And so now it's my job to make sense of it. So the family is important because they're not in, they're not in the land. The servant is not allowed to take a wife for Isaac from any of the Canaanites. That's going to be something that Esau has a problem with, because he ends up taking two wives from, well, one from the Canaanites and one from Ishmael's family. But there's a link back, and that also gets back to the generations of Terah. So it's not the generations of Abram Abraham in chapter 11. It's Terah. So there's something significant about this family in that God has chosen one from them, and things are in getting this family, this line of this promised line started. It's this family that God has chosen. And so Abraham sends him there, sends the servant there, because of the family connection. They're outside the land, coming from a similar place from where they were. And
so if they weren't practicing Canaanites, what were they?
Who?
Their whole family before
Abraham. They were moon god worshippers.
Wasn't everybody except Abraham and his?
Yeah, even at the time that God called Abram, he was a moon worshiper. What's the passage in the prophets that says that? One of the minor prophets. I can't remember. So they all were like.
So the Canaanites are different than the moon worshippers?
Yeah, so the Canaanites would be the ones that we would think they're in Israel.
They're in the promised.
Yeah, they're in the promised land, where Abraham is coming from is somewhere around is north and northeast of there, toward where the Tigris and Euphrates rivers are, if you know your Middle Eastern geography. So they're outside of the land. Or really, actually, by the time you get the border, the borders of the land given and expanded by David and Solomon, the River Euphrates actually becomes the northern border, the northern extent of the land. But I think is that where Ur?
Yeah, Ur.
Yeah,
that's where it came from.
That's on the other side of the river, right? That's on the other side of the Euphrates?
Oh.
Well, that doesn't really matter, but...
I'm pulling up the map.
Okay. Yeah. So they're not in Canaan. Abram doesn't come from Canaan. Yeah. And the reason for that is because they're corrupting. The Canaanites corrupt. Does that help a little bit? I know it doesn't answer everything.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, right. Joey, were you going
to
say something?
I was going to say, Abraham didn't send his servant to Bethuel.
Mm.
He says, you'll go to my land and to my kin.
Yeah.
So finding someone, and then God led him to family of
Right. And kin would be relatives.
Right.
So
yes, he wanted a relative, but it wasn't specifically that family.
Yeah.
Somebody who was his relative.
Right.
So
right.
Whoever that would have been would have probably fallen in the same
boat. Yeah.
I don't know if that's what you were asking directly, like why did he send to this family knowing that they're, or is it just in general the kin who are the moon worshippers? Like maybe I'm still in the hairs of the question.
But God sent him to Bethuel. Mm-hmm. It was God's plan.
Yes.
He worked it out.
Yeah, yeah. The direction. Yeah.
So Ur is up by Babylon.
Oh, okay. So it's a little bit more. So they travel from Ur to, then they travel from Ur to somewhere north, northwest.
Yeah. So what would that be? Modern day Iraq,
right?
Yeah. Haran. Where's Haran?
Haran, that's
yeah. That's north of Israel. Yeah, it's still around where the the Euphrates is.
Or Syria. Anyway,
it was out of Canaan, I guess, right?
They intended to go from Ur to Canaan, but they stopped at Haran at the end of chapter 11.
That's right. That was part of it.
Yeah, Haran was the missing piece. Yeah, thank you for that. That okay. So okay. Isaac's 40 years old, and then when he gets married to Rebecca, and then Rebecca is not conceiving. She's barren. So who does this make her like? Who is she like here?
Sarah.
So there seems to be some kind of pattern here. If the promises are tied to a son, tied to the next generation coming, then this is another situation now with Isaac rather than Abraham. In comparison to Abraham, where faith is forced out. This is a situation that forces the faith of Isaac to go into play, right? To be enacted.
To pray.
Specifically to pray.
Yeah.
Because think about the difference between what Abraham did and what Isaac is doing.
Oh, true.
What does Abraham do?
Listens to his wife
yeah. In regard to Hagar. He does talk to God about it, like, hey, you said this, and so there's some similarities and then there's some differences, but all we have here is Isaac praying for his wife. Now this is going to be contrasted with Jacob later on when Rachel comes to him and complains, and Jacob's just like, I'm not God. Like, oh, Jacob, learn from your dad, right? So this is one of the places where Isaac's good. Like, there's no prompting. It's just, and he prayed for his wife, prayed to the Lord for his wife because she was barren.
Is there any significance to that prayed? Because LSB translated it says entreaty.
Yeah, I was just going to bring that up. So the significance is in this, that... because what does the following sentence say as far as Yahweh?
And Yahweh moved by his entreaty.
Was moved, yeah. Now this, so these two words, so granted and prayed are actually the same word. One is active and one is passive. So Isaac entreated the Lord for his wife because she was barren, and the Lord was entreated by Isaac's prayer. So this, another way to say this is basically Isaac prayed and God was prayed too. He received the prayer. Like, the relationship is working. Right? And so it's not a give and take, it's just this is a healthy relationship. Right? But we don't know anything about Isaac at this point, except that what we've known about him with, you know, back in chapter 22 with being bound up and almost sacrificed and then being given back to Abraham, and then he receives Rebecca, he's part of the burial.
Talk about faith, you know, him having faith increased by saying, God, do that for him, you know, in his, you know.
With his wife conceiving?
No, as a kid, or however old he was. Oh, with the ram being, yeah. I mean, wow. You know, it's like, okay, this God is real.
Mm-hmm.
He is real.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and he's also being told, you are the son that I was promised, that we were promised. You know, mom and dad are both saying, and mom and dad are like really old. Like, you guys are
great-grandparents.
Older than... You're my parents, but you're older than my friend's grandparents. Like, you guys are old. What happened? Right? He wouldn't even have to ask that, but that, you know. So there's, but there's obviously just this, it's so straightforward that you like, you want to overinterpret this, but this is just, here's the relationship. It's, this is a blessed relationship. God is for Isaac. He's for the fulfillment of the promises, and the promises have to do with the next generation, with a son. And so what happened, Isaac prays, the Lord hears the prayer, and Rebekah conceives.
Do we know a time frame in that? Like, we knew with Abraham, we saw the story played out over
chapters
that it was 40 years.
We'll hear how long. It's 20 years.
Okay, from him praying and her conceiving?
From the time they get married to the time that she conceives or gives birth is 20 years. So yeah, we skip over quite a lot.
Right. Yeah. Sometimes when we read the Bible, we don't realize this passage of time, but that's...
And Isaac will... Yeah, yeah. So Isaac here is about 60, and he dies when he's 180. So both Esau and Jacob are 120 when Isaac dies. And this is also why Jacob complains that he's too young to die when he's 140-some. So... Jacob's just this guy.
Yeah, he is.
Just like us. Okay, so yeah, so but we find that out later, I think, in this passage. Okay, so she conceives, and then normally when you conceive, there's one child, right? But then automatically we're introduced, like, okay, the children struggle. So now I'll read this and then go through what God says. The children struggled together within her, and she said, "If it is thus, if it is this way, why is this happening to me?" So she went to inquire of the Lord. And the Lord said to her, "Two nations are in your womb, and two peoples from within you shall be divided. The one shall be stronger than the other. The older shall serve the younger." Okay, so what do you observe here? She prays. Yeah, she went to inquire.
So was she saying, why is this happening? Why is this, you know, she had been terribly uncomfortable.
Yeah, that would be terrible. You know. Because, okay, so this word struggled, I need to find my note on this.
If it is thus, yeah, I don't understand what that means.
Thus?
If it is thus.
So if it is this way, if this is the way that it is, why is it this way?
So why they struggle?
So this is translating straight from Hebrew into English and
she's like, why?
Counting on us to understand in English, like, what's going on. Like, why is it this way?
Okay.
Why is this happening? So it's this way. So if the condition is it's this way, if it's this way where these children are struggling within me, why is it happening?
Okay.
Right? Does that make sense?
Probably hoping that God said it was just something you ate.
Yeah. So, and it definitely wasn't, because this word struggle, it actually has to do with a crushing or breaking or violent collision. So, ladies.
It's not a normal thing that's happening.
No, this is not like.
And the other women probably, they were like, we don't know either.
Maybe, yeah.
Well, you know what I'm saying?
Oh,
yeah.
The baby's kicking.
Yeah. I remember a trip with Jude. It was Jude in particular. He would get up and into her ribs here, and she's just like pushing down. I'm like, what are you doing? I'm like,
what are you doing there, Jude?
I
don't know. He was trying to hug her from these.
Yeah. So, yeah. So, but this is not just like, you know, just general womb movement or anything like that. These kids are fighting from the beginning.
You know, you look at these and you wonder, I wonder why God orchestrated it the way he did. And because all of this is orchestrated by God.
Yeah.
He had the plan, the reason why he did this. Of course, if you read A.W. Pink, he would say there's a whole lot of pictures and types in here.
Oh, I'm sure he does. A.W. Pink, you can count on him for that. Yeah. But let's get into this and then we can talk about that for a moment. So why is this happening to me? And so Rebekah does what Isaac does, and she goes to inquire. And this is, so she just asks directly of the Lord, and the Lord speaks to her. So the Lord responds to her. So, I mean, this is, good things are happening. I mean, as far as the relationship goes,
yeah.
But it's only going to last so long because their kids are at war with one another, even before they're born. And the Lord said to her, so two nations. So one woman brings forth two nations. Two nations, two peoples, and they shall be divided. Two peoples from within you shall be divided. The one shall be stronger than the other. So one's going to be stronger, and the older shall serve the younger. So serve, it's like slave imagery. So the older, referring to one of these two peoples, one of these two nations, the older of them will, the older nation will serve the younger, the nation that comes from the older child will serve the nation that comes from the younger child. And there's going to be conflict. So God says this is what Danny was saying there. This is ordained by God. That this is how it is. Now, there are other passages in the Bible that talk about this, this passage, and then this whole concept. Not concept, but whole just the divisive, divided relationship. Can anybody remember passages that refer to Jacob and Esau being against each other? Specifically, the nations that come from them?
Romans
9. And that, so Romans 9, 12 is one. We'll actually turn there for a moment, in a moment. But what else? Really famous one in Malachi.
Jacob, I love Esau.
Yeah. And that's in Malachi 1. Right? So, but even before we turn to Romans, God is saying up front, okay, they're in conflict because they're different. They're too different. And God is making a distinction. One is going to be stronger than the other, and the older is going to serve the younger. This one is pretty ambiguous. What does it mean to be stronger than the other? But this one clarifies it. Okay? Clarifies the ambiguous line. So the younger is the one who's going to have preeminence. All right? So just for a moment, Paul talks about this over in Romans, so Romans 9, and he actually references the Malachi passage, so we can do both at the same time. So Romans 9, the quotation is in verse 12, but it begins with Paul lamenting over Israel rejecting Christ, meaning that they've rejected. They've rejected, the nation has rejected Christ, rejected the gospel, rejected Paul's gospel. However, it's not as though the word of God has failed. So it's not fallen. It's not as though the promises of God are void. Why? Because not all are descended from Israel, who are descended from Israel belong to Israel. And so this is where he starts to make a distinction between those who are the true Israel and those who are not. And he demonstrates this second part, not all who are descended from Israel belong to Israel. From this, not all are children of Abraham because they are his offspring. Just because you're a child of Abraham doesn't mean you're actually a child of Abraham, in the sense that Paul is talking about. Why? But through Isaac shall your offspring be named, right? So this is Genesis. What is this? Is there a footnote in here? Through Isaac shall your offspring be named. I just went blank on this. On verse 7. Genesis 21:12. Okay. Referring back to Genesis 21:12, through Isaac shall your offspring be named. And this would be in contrast to Ishmael, This means that it is not the children of the flesh or the children of God, but the children of the promise who are counted as offspring. For this is what the promise said. So it's children of the promise. This is the key thing for Paul here. This is what the promise said. About this time next year, I will return and Sarah shall have a son. This is Genesis 18. And not only so, but also Rebecca. Now we go to the next generation, and this is our passage, Genesis 25. Also, when Rebecca had conceived children by one man, our forefather Isaac, though they were not yet born and had done nothing, either good or bad, in order that God's purpose of election might continue, not because of works, but because of him who calls, she was told, the older shall serve the younger, as it is written, and this is the Malachi 1 passage, Jacob I loved and Esau I hated. So loved has to do with choice. Right, with election, and the older shall serve the younger, Genesis 25. So in the bigger picture of what Paul is talking about in Romans 9, who's the Israel that will accept Christ, who will trust in the Messiah, the Israel that God has chosen, those whom he has called. And so the sovereign purposes of God are not forfeit simply because of the disobedience of the nation of Israel. Chapter 10 is going to talk about why Israel is disobedient, because they love their own righteousness rather than the righteousness of God. And then chapter 11 says that God's going to fulfill his purposes for Israel, and he's going to use Gentiles, us, to provoke them to jealousy because of the blessings that we're receiving because of our relationship with Christ, Israel's Messiah, right? So all Paul is doing here is to say that this is how it's always worked in Israel's history. God makes the choice. He makes a distinction between one from another, all right? Does everybody see that? Okay. And so, Paul is drawing that from Genesis 25, and that actually sets the trajectory for Israel and its relationship with Edom that comes from Esau. Any questions on that? I don't know if that scratched your typology itch there, Danny, but it sure did mine.
I think it's interesting how Abraham's firstborn becomes a great nation, but he's not the one. And the secondborn, it's the same thing here. It's not going to be the first one. The firstborn, that's
the
chosen nation. Good. Is the second one.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Like, I've seen this before.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And then that whole thing gets exacerbated when Jacob has 12 sons. So, and that's like the rest of the book, like who's the son, right? Who's the one who's going to carry this forward? Okay, so she's told, here's the first, this is the first struggle between the two. It's in the womb, violent collisions going on in the womb. And then when her days to give birth were completed, behold, there were twins in her womb. The first came out red and all his body like a hairy cloak. So they called him Esau. Afterward, his brother came out with his hand holding Esau's heel, so his name was called Jacob. Isaac was 60 years old. There it is, 60 years old when she bore them. So you think about, we don't know when Isaac prayed, but it's at some point within this 20 years, and it may have been toward the end of the 20 years. But that's all we're given about it. And it's according to God's timing, but he uses the prayer of Isaac to bring that to fulfillment. So that would be another encouragement to us that we continue to pray. We continue to call to the Lord.
Do we have any record of Abraham praying for a child?
No, Genesis 15, he complains that the heir of his house, so God has promised a son, and all Abraham has is Eliezer, his maid servant.
Okay.
And that's when God says he's going to have a son. Or that from his own body, he's going to have an heir. So do you consider that prayer? Mm-hmm. I would. I mean, yeah. And God actually instigates that, right? He comes to Abraham there.
But he didn't describe it the same way as he did Isaac's. I don't know, when Moses wrote it, he didn't say, Abraham went to the Lord and inquired.
Right, yeah.
Or asked.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a different idea.
Right, yeah. I think the simplicity of it leads us in that direction. Like, Isaac's, at this point in his life, he's got it right. Yeah, he's got a good relationship with God, trusting relationship with God. And that actually gets tested when the boys are born here. What do you observe about the birth here?
It was weird.
So what's weird about it?
A baby with red hair.
Okay, so the first is red and hairy. Yeah, so red.
Like a cloak.
Yeah.
Usual for a newborn.
Hairy cloak. Yep. Yep.
Came good. Out of his own blanket.
Good. There's not necessarily a link between the name Esau and red or hairy. So there's no link there. So I should actually cross
That's
these
weird,
out.
But
So they called him. Yeah. So they called him Esau. Hmm. Hairy actually kind of is related to sire, which is Mount Sire in Edom. That's what Edom is known for later on. And so that like presages that the red is what we're about to see when in the birthright narrative. Give me some of that red stuff. So this is his birth. Basically, it's like, okay, here's what you need to know about Esau. He's red, and that's related to the red stuff that's going to come. And then he's also hairy, and that has to do with the future capital of his people.
Doesn't Edom mean red?
Edom means red. Yeah,
it
does, yeah, Esau. Yeah. So that's where he gets his when he talks about the red stuff. It's just an offhanded comment later on, and thus, so his name was Edom. That's why they called him Edom, is because of this event right here. Yeah. So
what does Esau mean?
What does Esau mean? We actually don't know. Yeah. There's not like an etymological link between this word and another word. So, yeah.
It could mean hairy red guy.
It could, but the problem is, hairy sounds more like sire, and red is Edom, like Esedom. No,
you're just speculating.
I think I'm trying to keep from speculating.
So the word "so" in Hebrew, I mean,
here,
where it says, because it says the verse came out red and hairy. So they called him Esau. So I get, I mean, what Joey's saying, does it mean hairy red guy?
Does NASB have so here? And yeah, that's, this is actually.
Instead of so, it says and.
Hmm. Yeah. And the conjunction, what is so here or and in other translations, it's really dynamic. It's flexible. And so
that's
ESV.
What I was asking. I didn't know if the Hebrew.
It doesn't.
Language.
That's an interpretive decision.
Okay.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
Okay. But it does kind of throw you off because it makes you think that Esau is related to hairy and red.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So there's Esau, and then we have afterward. So verse 25 basically says, here's the older, right? We go back up to verse 23, right? Older shall serve the younger. And so now here's the younger. And what is the younger doing? Here's God's choice. Here's God's choice, right? What is he doing?
Holding
Holding on to his
breath. Holding Esau's heel.
Which I think would also be unique in the birth, because I thought with twins you give birth to one and then you give birth to the other.
They don't come out at the same time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So Jacob, the name is related to what's going on here. Heel grabber.
God is known as deceiver.
Yeah. Heel, yes, which in a concrete way, you think about that, it's heel grabber. Because if you do something with your heel towards somebody that who trusts you, you are deceptive. So Psalm 41:9 talks about someone lifting up his heel against the psalmist, meaning that he's been deceived by that person. This is the holding on is a firm grip, so it's not like, oh, it's cute, he's holding on to my finger, right? Like, no, this is holding on for dear life. It's the struggle continues from the womb out. It's continuing. I keep these kids separated. Not a good idea to have them together. So what we're already seeing, or what we're getting indications of about Jacob, is that he's deceptive. He's opportunistic. Actually, we don't see this deceptive necessarily yet, but he's opportunistic, right? Oh, you're going out. I'm going to slide right out behind you. And then he's opportunistic, and he's, deceptive with the heel grabbing. But we're going to see that. But he takes advantage of opportunities. And so his name was called Jacob. So that's the second conflict. Now we get some background information that'll help us understand the birthright. So when the boys grew up, Esau was a skillful hunter, a man of the field, while Jacob was a quiet man dwelling in tents. Isaac loved Esau because he ate of his game, but Rebekah loved Jacob. So what do you observe here?
It's a terrible parenting choice to pick one you like more.
Dysfunctional
parenting. Okay, so dysfunctional. And that is actually going to have major ramifications for Jacob in particular, with Rebekah going to send him away, right? Okay. Just on this note, JD, they didn't have room. So he and Justice shot a deer a couple months ago, and they didn't have room in their freezer for the meat. And so they gave us the meat, and it was really good. And it's like game meat, you know? And so, like, I kind of understand what Isaac's talking about. That's good stuff. I couldn't relate to this until that. So anyway, but you're right to see there's a division here between the two. What else do you observe?
Difference in the boys. I mean, the difference.
Good. Yeah.
My translation says peaceful man.
Yeah,
it says
peaceful.
Okay, instead of quiet. Good. So this word means blameless.
Yeah, I know it says literally complete.
Complete, yeah. Complete,
yeah.
Blameless, peaceful, whole. It's not saying this in contrast to Esau being a skillful hunter. It's saying that this is, it's actually making it ironic, because it's about to show he's not that.
Yeah.
So it's more of an ironic thing. But this quiet, blameless, complete, he's dwelling in tents. Now we need to think, okay, family picture. Abraham. Who else, I just gave it away, who else dwelled in tents?
Abraham,
right? I mean, this is Abraham doesn't go out and hunt. So Isaac is like, I'm sorry, Jacob is like Abraham. Who else is he like? And this is weird. Where is Isaac found when they come back? when the servant comes back with Rebecca? In the field around the tents, right?
It says that he was meditating in the field.
Yeah, I mean, meditate. Yeah, praying.
Watching the beard.
Watching the what? Oh, yeah, perhaps. Maybe he was out on a hunt. And it just happened to be around. Like, Isaac, that's not a very smart place to hunt. He probably won't come near those tents. So Jacob is like the family. Esau's not. But Isaac loves Esau because of this game thing. Like, he likes the meat that this boy brings home. Right? So, I mean, this is different. We're not eating lamb. We're eating stag or something.
Just because they didn't have good beef back in those days.
Perhaps, yeah. So, and remember, they're nomadic. They're going from place to place. They're not settled. And Jacob is taking that up. And so there's actually a preference being shown here that, like, yeah, this is actually preferable to the hunter. I'm interpreting that a little bit, but I think that it's significant that Jacob's more like Abraham and Isaac than Esau. And yeah.
It's interesting in Hebrews 11, I never thought of this before, but when it mentions Abraham dwelling in tents with Isaac and Jacob, it doesn't mention Esau.
Yeah.
The verse about dwelling in tents.
Yeah. And it's not until, yeah, that's good. That's good. And the next chapter, Esau sought repentance even with tears and didn't find it. And didn't find the blessing, not repentance. Because that's what he was searching after. Yeah, good. Okay, so division, difference between the two boys. And now the third conflict. Esau sells his birthright. Once, when Jacob was cooking stew, Esau came in from the field, and he was exhausted. And Esau said to Jacob, "Let me eat some of that red stew, for I am exhausted." Therefore, his name was called Edom. Jacob said, "Sell me your birthright now." Esau said, "I'm about to die. Of what use is a birthright to me?" Jacob said, "Swear to me now." So he swore to him and sold his birthright to Jacob. Then Jacob gave Esau bread and lentil stew, and he ate and drank and rose and went his way. Thus, in this way, Esau despised his birthright. So what do you observe there?
It's a little dramatic.
Who's dramatic?
Esau.
You think Esau's dramatic?
Yeah.
I mean, have you ever had an unsuccessful hunt and that's what you depend on for food? And like, we don't know how long he's been out.
Do they depend on it for food because they are shepherds?
I mean, Esau's the hunter. He's a skillful hunter.
But he ate lentil stew. I mean, that didn't say game stew.
You're right. Because I'm getting after something. Esau's the skillful hunter, and what is he coming back with?
Nothing.
How skillful is he? Right? Which actually suggests the other side of this. So how skillful is Esau if he can't even come back with something? When on an extended hunt, right? Extended enough to where he is famished, right? We just take him for his word. Like, we've been hungry before, but maybe not as hungry as this guy is right now. But so he's skillful. He's come back with nothing. So how skillful is he? And so that actually introduces the question, okay, so how quiet is Jacob? How blameless is Jacob? Do you see how that works? So there doesn't seem to be this contrast between Esau and Jacob in verse 27 until you get to the story. It's like, oh, wait a second, Esau is a failure. What about Jacob?
Schemer.
And we see that in this passage too, right?
But when he came in from the field, then he was exhausted. I mean, maybe he had multiple animals.
Here's what we can't do. Don't give Esau the benefit of the doubt.
I know, but I don't see that it says that he was not successful that day.
Well, so he's a skillful hunter.
Yep.
Right? Mm-hmm. So skillful means he's able to get the job done. He can apply any kind of method in order to kill kill game and bring it back for food. And he could also, while he's out on the hunt, eat of the game that he's killed while he's out there. So right? So but he hasn't done that. So that throws into,
I didn't know if they would bring it back to camp and then they would cook
while, right, yeah,
he supplied them.
Yeah.
But I might be reading too much to it too, because later on when Isaac wants the, he's gonna do the blessing, he sends Esau out, mm-hmm, and says, hey, let's give me some meat and some stew with the meat in it. And he goes and does it and has it prepared and all that kind of stuff. So was God, in this particular case, we know he's skillful, so we know he can kill animals and do all that kind of stuff. But this particular time, perhaps he, you know, it doesn't sound like he was successful.
Right. Well, and yeah, so I think the point is, like, we're introduced to Esau. Like, what is this guy known for? Being a skillful hunter. And then the first time that we actually see him in action with this, he's a failure. So how skillful is he? So later on, so that would, it would make sense if we say, if when Isaac sends him out to get game and then I'm going to give you the blessing here in a couple chapters, then, well, Esau's a skillful hunter, right? And actually Jacob plays off of that, right? Because when he comes and Isaac's like, how are you getting back here so fast? And he's like, well, the Lord provided, you know? And that's actually the first problem with Jacob and Rebecca's whole scheme, is like, he has to talk. Like, he could smell and feel like Esau, but then if he has to open his mouth, then the plan has failed. This is put in relation here. Esau fails, but we've just been told he's a skillful hunter. Something is off. Something's wrong.
Couldn't it be that God just didn't allow game to show up for him to use this skill?
Yeah, but that's not what the text says.
But it also doesn't say that he wasn't skillful.
Yeah,
it says that he was skillful and he comes back without game.
How do you know that? We know that.
Where does it say
he because he's without game? He's famished.
No.
He hasn't eaten.
They're all turning on you, Noah.
I know.
It
doesn't say he's exhausted.
Maybe so, he caught so much game.
So why is he going to eat the stew?
Because he hadn't eaten. He'd been working so hard.
But why is he going to eat? Why wouldn't he eat the game that he?
Maybe he's a vegetarian.
Because he was busy. He was busy when he done it. I don't know.
That's okay.
I don't see that in the text.
That's okay.
And I have a question. How would it be that Isaac loves Esau because he had an appetite for hunting game? That could have happened.
Yeah, he gets the reputation. He gets the reputation.
Right.
So I'm not saying that he doesn't have the reputation for being a skillful hunter. Just saying in this case, he failed.
Yes.
So.
And that's all we can say.
And
maybe.
Yeah, okay, I am inferring something. And biblically, we are allowed to infer things. So I am inferring something from the text.
We don't have to infer that he really failed on his birthright.
Right, and that's what all of this is leading to.
Yeah.
What does he sell it for?
Yeah.
Like, because if he does care about his birthright, then I don't want this red stuff.
Yeah.
I've got all this game, right?
Yeah.
So even if he does have the game, then it's even worse.
He was just indifferent.
Yeah, he doesn't care about this.
Right.
So.
But like, where is Rebecca and why isn't she stopping this?
No. We do not give Rebecca any credit. She, besides her inquiring of the Lord, that's her high point.
Okay.
That's her high point.
She would probably encourage this.
So.
And they're just allowed to just like make this contract and everyone respects it?
I know. they're 12 years old and they're trading birthrights. You know? Yeah. So this is given as an example of Esau just being a complete doof, and he doesn't care about the family. He's going to demonstrate that when he gets married twice, right? Because that disappoints Isaac as well. So everything Esau does is bad. And because God is saying, here's why Edom doesn't like you, and you shouldn't like Edom. Right? So, I mean, this is all setting up for the nations, because the nations have been sold or have been talked about earlier in the passage. So we need to be careful not to be Christians at this point and give people the benefit of the doubt. Do not give Esau the benefit of the doubt, because when you do that, you're also going to give Jacob the benefit of the doubt when you shouldn't. He's going to do some dumb stuff. And you're like, oh, he was such a great guy. Let's be just like Jacob. No, we should not be just like Jacob. We should be better than Jacob.
You know, this brings out, too, I mean, the fact that, humanly speaking, it was Esau's character that was bad. It was him.
Mm-hmm.
But yet, to begin with, God had already said,
right,
I hate
before him. Either one yeah. was born.
And which, again, brings the contrast yeah. between God's sovereignty and, mm-hmm. and the choice that he made to be that kind of
right.
person. So, he had that freedom to do it.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you think Rebecca shared with Isaac, the younger is going to serve,
I don't think she did.
Because God told her, she knew that. She had that yeah. promise from God.
She may have, but we don't have any indication in here that she did.
That the younger right. would be the one.
And so she's just like her brother, and her son is just like her, where they scheme. And so Rebecca's like, the blessing's going to go to Esau? No, this isn't how it's supposed to work. So that indicates how that, I don't think she talked to him about it. We definitely don't have anything in the text that says that she did.
Well, do you think Esau despised his birthright because he knew family stories or somehow knew that Jacob was going to be the favorite?
So the text also doesn't tell us that. We can infer things, but I don't think that's something, a good inference from the text because of how he goes about this. And so we just skip to the end.
What exactly is his birthright?
Good. It's not told. We're not told what it is. So, but the birthright is, or what is a birthright? It's a firstborn's privilege of honor over other sons because he symbolized the father's power and potency. So,
wasn't there double inheritance as well?
I thought there was.
Yeah, but this doesn't have anything to do with inheritance. This is just who has the most honor.
Okay. Because it's the blessing is separate. Okay.
The blessing is separate.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, the blessing is separate. So birthright is about honor.
Okay.
Honor within the family.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
So it tells you he despised that.
Yeah,
that honor.
And how he does it is this way. So he likes meat, and there's no meat in this. So this red stew, it's made out of lentil. Have you ever had lentil stew? I mean, it's just, ugh.
Lentils are delicious.
Okay. All right. Sorry, I like game. Apparently, I'm in the wrong place. I just got told, yelling at everybody, not to like Esau. Don't give him the benefit of the doubt. Like, I don't like lentils.
I'm making red lentil soup for Wednesday.
And you'll have to fill a bowl for me, because I won't do it myself.
But he had some bread. He had some bread, too.
There was some bread, too, yeah. Yeah.
As an old person, the lentils have a lot of fiber.
Okay, so he eats the lentil stew. And this is how it's given. So this is the contract. I'm gonna build into this and then we'll be done. Came in the field. He's exhausted. He's famished. This is another way to say he's famished. And Esau said, "Now, I'll give one thing to Esau. He's polite because this word is please." Please let me eat some of that red stew because I'm exhausted. I'm famished. Okay, so he is polite, and that's going to contrast something from stuff. But he's also like really unrefined. And this is, unfortunately, this is also like, what are we having for dinner? If you tell me what it is, if Tripp tells me what we're having, like some like tortellini or whatever, and like, I don't know what that is. Like, is that pasta or is cream colored? Does it have stuff in it? You know, like, so unrefined. Okay. So again, I'm like, Esau, this is a bad thing. But that's he doesn't know what it is. I just want that. Whatever it is that you're doing, I want that. And this is why his name is called Edom, related to red. And Jacob says, remember, Esau's polite. Jacob says, sell me your birthright now. Like, whoa, that really escalated. And so what is Jacob right now? He is opportunistic.
He's waiting for the opportunity.
Yeah. Because he knows what this is all about. Well, maybe he doesn't know what this is all about, but he wants the highest place of honor in the family as the son who would be the firstborn, be considered the firstborn son. So he's opportunistic. So he's taking advantage of Esau while he is, mm-hmm. Totally vulnerable. Yeah, exactly. So sell me your birthright and do it now, right? Esau, here's his reasoning. He doesn't say something like, let me take a moment to think about this. A birthright is really worth more than, I'm sure I'm not dying, like right now, I'm taking my last breath. He doesn't do anything like that. He's like, I'm about to die. What's a birthright honor useful to me if I'm dead, right? So that's his reasoning. A little dramatic, like you said. He's a little dramatic. Okay, so, but that just kind of plays into what he is. Like and we're going to see this at the end. Like when Jacob and Esau come back together, Jacob leaves because Esau says, I'm going to kill him once dad's dead, right? But when Jacob comes back and Jacob goes through this whole thing of like just flocks and, you know, just here's all of me and then here's this tremendous gift and all of that. And Esau's like, what are all these, brother? And he's like, oh, it's for you, my Lord. And Esau's like, water under the bridge. We're good. I mean, look at all my stuff. I'm totally rich. He does not care about God, his promises, anything like that, right?
Or the covenants that God had made with Abraham, his grandfather.
Yeah.
He didn't care about any of that stuff.
But did Jacob care?
We don't see
he that. Comes to care. God has to cause him to limp for the rest of his life to do it. But yeah. Yeah. That's way in the future. So maybe in a decade we'll get there. It'll be a shorter amount of time than it took for Jacob to get there. Okay, so I'm about to die. What use is his birthright to me? Swear to me now. So swear, take an oath, make this official. So Esau swore to him and sold his birthright to Jacob. And it's at this point that Jacob gives bread and lentil stew to Esau, and how does Esau approach it? He eats, he drinks, he rises, and he goes. And it's in this way, in these ways, that Esau despised his birthright. He undervalued it, would be another way to put it. This is how little Esau thought of the birthright from his family. Within his family. So Esau, bad guy. Jacob, doesn't look too good for him either. He doesn't seem to be the peaceful, quiet, blameless guy that he's described to be. So earlier in the passage. So this is, I think one takeaway, really quickly, one takeaway from this, for us and just thinking about our own lives and thinking about the church, is that whether you think about it as dramatic and unrefined and in Esau's case or in Jacob's case where he's opportunistic and all of that, but particularly Jacob, God starts with us somewhere and he grows us from there. So when's the best day? When's the best time to grow in greater and greater Christlikeness? Today. Right today, and just look at where God is starting with Jacob. This is the one that even before he's born, what Danny's been talking about, before he's even born, God is saying Jacob's the one, and Jacob is a jerk. Are you serious, God? And then that should actually put the mirror back to us. Say, me? Are you serious? And then that leads to exalting the grace of God, magnifying the mercy of God, and his love for us. Like, we do not deserve this. And so it's the Spurgeon quote, we can end on this, that somebody comes to Spurgeon and says, "Pastor, I can't believe this. God says that it says that I hated Esau. And how can that be? How can God hate Esau?" And Spurgeon says, "I know. How could he love Jacob?" All right? I mean, that's the question. We would expect, because of our sin, we would expect the other way around. So, any concluding thoughts?
I've been wondering if, but maybe what you just said kind of answered this. With a lot of the Old Testament narrative, there seems to be like this regular, these times where God breaks with convention, and it really is more to, I guess, keep us from thinking, you know, linearly or thinking according to conventions. Is this one of those cases where...
It becomes that, especially with you're talking about with choosing Jacob?
Right. With choosing Jacob, but also with it not being the firstborn son. Or,
yeah. Yeah.
Because we're learning, like later on, we're comparing, you know, like the nation of Israel or the Judaite or the Pharisees. And then that's when God is, or when Jesus is talking about, that distinction, I guess.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's God's choice and it's God's mercy. It's God's grace. And even in Genesis, Isaac doesn't get it. Like, Isaac thinks it's his responsibility to pass the blessing on, and he chooses Esau. Mm-hmm. And Rebecca freaks out and says, "We got to do something about this." And it's actually later on that God blesses Jacob. It's not dependent on the father blessing the son. It's right. Dependent on God doing the blessing. So, so it does break with convention, and it's God is the one who chooses, because it's his prerogative,
right?
Not based on background, not based right. on birth order, yeah. not based on anything. Yeah.
So if you're praying for someone, but they're not like predestined, preordained by God, is it even any use?
Well, we don't know. We don't know if they're predestined or not. Only God knows. And we know several things about God. He's merciful. He's gracious. He's loving. There wasn't anything in you that would cause him to love you. There is hope. As long as that person breathes, there is hope. Because of who God is. For how predestination works for us, we see it in hindsight. God's obviously predestines it before time begins, but we only see the after effects of it, the consequence of it. We don't go around trying to understand who's predestined, and then base our evangelistic efforts on that.
We God told us to go into the world and preach the gospel to every
creature.
So we yep. do that with God. Yep. Our responsibility mm-hmm. is to give the gospel to yep. everyone.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. And the reason why predestination is not this scary boogeyman or anything like that is because that actually gives us hope that the people that we do talk to, God has his people out there. There are those whom he has, according to his sovereign goodness and wisdom and love, that he has chosen from before the beginning of time to save, according to his mercy, not according to our works. So those people are out there. So that should give us hope, not cause us to worry. And that's the doctrine of election, doctrine of predestination, is not for unbelievers. It's for believers. Meaning, it is to be taught to believers. It is to be received by believers. It is to be an encouragement to believers. It's not to be used as an apologetic. It's not intended to defend the honor of God or anything like that. That doctrine is something we hold close to our hearts. And it gives us hope and it gives us comfort. It's not always used that way.
That is not how I was taught about it.
Yeah, it's not always used that way. It's regularly not used that way. But whenever you read passages in the Bible about predestination and things like that, the goodness, the mercy, the love of God is on full display in predestination and election every time. And so that's how we need to receive it. and the questions that we have about it, we can pursue those as far as we go, but we're going to hit a wall. We're going to hit a wall of revelation where God has not revealed anything beyond a certain point, and we need to receive that. Receive that from Him as a gift, and also entrust our remaining questions to Him, knowing that He knows what's good, He knows what's best, He's wise. So
predestination is the whole Bible, because God has predestined everything that's going to happen, and it's going to happen. And whether it's His choice as far as salvation, whether it's His choice of what nation falls or doesn't, it's all up to Him, because He's predestined.
Yep.
I think that ties with taking like whatever God says is going to happen despite what man tries to do. And I think I see it in this passage here, back in verse 23, where he's telling Rebecca, and the older shall serve the younger. And then you get to 27, Esau is a skillful hunter. He doesn't need Jacob, but whatever happened, he's failed, and now you see him dependent upon Jacob. And even with their own skills, like, God's word is still, it seems like what God said even takes place no matter our abilities and skills and schemes and all that. Like, it's what He said, what God says, that's happening. Yeah. He's faithful. Yeah. Not always faithful, but He's right.
It's true. I think whenever you see that, somebody prays for something and it says that God answered that prayer, then, like, whenever you start thinking, like, well, what would He have done it anyways if the person wouldn't have prayed? But, and it doesn't talk about that. It just says He answered the prayer that was there. So, maybe we have more power than we think in terms of Him answering some sort of prayer that somebody has. So, I don't know. Otherwise, He would just say He just would have done whatever the heck He wanted to do. But He answered this prayer. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, I wouldn't put it in terms of power that we have in prayer.
Yeah.
But God uses our prayers according to His wisdom, according to His sovereign purposes. He uses our prayers to advance His plan. He uses our prayers toward the salvation of sinners. So He chooses to use us, to use our prayers, to listen and to respond. He doesn't have to, but that's the kind of God that we have, that He is.
When He commands us to pray, and we're taught to pray, all through the New Testament. Yep. And so we're supposed to pray. Mm-hmm. It's part of His plan. Yep.
And He desires our relationship.
Yeah.
After our questions, you're going to be like, you have to take that membership class again, because I don't want your kid. No.
Membership is just the introduction, and then it's just like, all right, we're together. Can't get rid of us. Just like you said, we can't get rid of you. It's the other way around. You can't get rid of us.
So. I just tripped that after she
got serious. So yeah. Okay. I'll pray for us, and we'll be dismissed. Father, we thank You for the time that You've given to us, and we thank You that You use such sinners and You transform them into saints. We see Jacob how we would expect to see the rest of the world here. And it's he's the one that You chose to advance the promises, to inherit the promises, and to be the one who'd be in the line that ultimately leads to the one who's truly blameless, the one who would deal with Jacob's sin and our sin. So we thank You that You alone are wise. And we give You glory for that. Father, help us to learn from the sin and the mistakes and the character flaws of both Esau and Jacob, and also Isaac and Rebecca. Help us to learn from them so that we would not repeat their mistakes, but to be faithful to Your word, and to keep our word, not exploit opportunities, but to respect where it is that You've placed us in this world, and not to seek to get ahead, but to seek to be faithful to You. So please help us to do that. We're in a world that lives the opposite way. So we ask that You would strengthen us according to the ministry of Your Spirit. We're thankful for your word. We're thankful for the church and how you've made us a part of it. We praise you and thank you for Jesus. And in his name, amen.
Amen.